pause here to have some questions, discussion about Zed. How are you doing with all of this?
If we have begun with Libra, that's how good.
Okay, so the beginning with Libra is having anybody know them all, because there's always more Libras to be known. Maybe we have to develop the idea of infinite ability to know things as well. So you have the railroad track with the parallel railroad track. One is the rebirth and one is the consciousness that knows it. And that you can ask to a Buddha also. I think all this kind of thing is like what it's pointing to is how we get stuck when we think of things that are infinite. Yeah? How difficult it is for us to think of infinity because we, you know, well, there's got to be one more rebirth to know, so how can I know everything? It's like we have this idea like I have to learn things one at a time, one at a time, one at a time. Whereas if you have an infinite mirror just reflects all of infinite space all at the same time. It doesn't have to keep growing inch by inch to be infinite. Okay, and yet something that's infinite, it has no boundaries, so we can't pinpoint it. Of being able to have a personal relationship with the Buddhas who actually have the ability to take care of us. And how that changes our attitude if we have that kind of confidence. Yeah. Feels very safe, huh? Not like we're out in the middle of empty space. But that there is help somewhere in the universe. Yeah. That's true that there's somebody's intending to help us.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think this is what it points to for me. What I see in my mind is that I really have to overcome my ideas of how I think the Buddha should manifest to help me. And if there's really a Buddha, this is what a Buddha should do so that I'll believe there's a Buddha. And if there's really a Buddha, this is what a Buddha should do to help me because this is how I think I need to be helped. Yeah. Now, maybe... And I have my very fixed, rigid ideas about this. Yeah. But then I have to ask myself, but do I really know the best ways to help myself? Do I really, really know that? You know, maybe the Buddha, from the Buddha's side, is trying to help me, and maybe I'm blocking out things because of my own stubbornness. Or maybe they're trying to help me, and I am receiving their help, but it looks to me like the world's falling apart around me because things are getting worse instead of better, and I think the Buddha should make everything better real quick instead of, you know, in these situations that are quite difficult, but they're a real opportunity to grow. Yeah. And so really having to work with my idea of, you know, Buddha, look, if you really exist, then I need this and this and this and this, you know, like Santa Claus, you know, like we're telling Santa Claus what we need to make us happy. So if you really exist, Buddha, you know, come on. Come on, Santa. You know? Yeah, right. Let's do this lesson another time when I'm more together, when I'm not falling apart at the seams. Can't I face it then? Yeah. I think it comes down to it, too. I think if you've raised kids, you know, that your kid may think one thing is good for him or her, but you have a broader view and a wisdom, and you know another thing is good. And you put your kid in that situation, even though the kid may not like it. Yeah. I mean, because I remember when I was little, my parents, I didn't like to go to places where I didn't know anybody. And my parents said, look, you know, look, you'll go, you'll meet people, you'll have a good time. And I didn't want to go. And they made me go. And I think they were really wise. Because they were right. I usually went and I had a good time. But beforehand, I was really obstinate. I didn't want to go. So, you know, somehow, you know, through parents having a bigger vision, then they can lead the child in that way. Even the kid might be, you know, throwing tantrums all the way to the place. So I think sometimes it works that way with the Buddhists trying to guide us, too. Yeah. So some of these qualities of the Buddha sound very much like qualities of God, and you just had decided that you didn't believe in any kind of being who was like that. No, Buddha is not God. Okay? There's a few big differences. Okay? One difference is the Buddha didn't create the world. Okay? Buddha did not invent samsara, did not invent cyclic existence. Buddha didn't invent karma. Buddha isn't making us suffer. Buddha didn't invent all the different rebirths. Didn't create anything. Okay, so that's a big difference. Okay? So another big difference is that a Buddha is not omnipotent. Okay? There's a difference between being omniscient and omnipotent. With omniscient, which is a quality a Buddha has, a Buddha can perceive everything that exists in the universe. Omnipotent is the ability to make anything happen that you want to happen. And the Buddha is not omnipotent. The Buddha cannot pull out our karma so that we don't have any problems anymore. And so, from a Buddhist viewpoint, you know, we would say there's nobody who's omnipotent. Because, you see, if somebody were fully compassionate and omnipotent and can change the world like that because they wanted to, then a Buddha certainly would have already, because there's no reason at all to make cyclic existence go on longer if you can stop it. Yeah? So there's no idea in Buddhism of, you know, Buddha looking over, watching us suffer so that we'll learn something. You know, there's none of that. If the Buddha could stop it, Buddha would. But Buddhas are not omnipotent in the sense that they, you know, they have great powers and abilities. From their own side, they're unobscured. But because things are dependent arising, they interact with the rest of the world and they can't make everything turn out the way they want it to. So those are two big differences. Yeah? Are there some other things that you want to, like, bring out, the qualities that made you feel uncomfortable here? Oh, goodness, yeah. That means somebody sitting there with a checklist of you've been good and you've been naughty. Somebody's spying on me and somebody's going to mark down the black points, the white points. Again, the idea in Buddhism is very, very different. Buddha isn't spying on us to see if we've been good or bad. Yeah? The Buddha just, the mind is like a mirror. It can perceive everything. But because the mind's fully compassionate, any information the Buddha gets is processed through that compassion. You know? So a Buddha isn't sitting there judging us like, oh, you lost your temper again today, oh boy, you know. But rather, you know, if a Buddha sees us lose our temper, they're able to watch us do that but have compassion for us. And then wouldn't it be nice if that person, weren't pushed by their uncontrolled emotions to do that? And wouldn't it be wonderful to help that person so that they can stop that habit? So the whole way the Buddha's looking at us is very different than the way we were brought up as children, maybe, to think of, you know, God looking at us, depending how you were brought up. Yeah? Does that make some sense? Yeah? Are there some other qualities? But I think that's real good. And as you think about these things, if more things start feeling uncomfortable, really bring them out. Because I think very often, you know, and we come to Buddha's teachings, and each of us has our different backpack on of past experiences. And so rather than just be limited or fight against our backpack, you know, it's good if we just set it down and take it out and look what's inside and see if we still need those things or not. Yeah, so really bring it out from you. Okay, so you're asking, like, how does meditation on emptiness purify the mind and enable somebody to become omniscient? I think it's really helpful to understand the different kinds of obscurations on the mind. Okay? And this will come up later, but, you know, it's good to go over it more than once. We often talk of two levels of obscuration. One is the deluded obscuration. The second one is the obscurations to omniscience. The deluded obscurations are the disturbing attitudes and their seeds, and that includes ignorance, anger, and attachment, and all the contaminated karmas that make us take rebirth and cyclic existence. Okay, once that level of obscurations has been removed, then one is an arhat. The mirror of one's mind is greatly cleaned, because you no longer have ignorance, anger, attachment, and these things. So simply because so much of your energy is not used in going in all these wrong perceptions, and it's not obscured by all the imprints of the karma you have from having gone in all those goofy ways, then the mind just automatically can perceive so much more. And so that's why an arhat has great clairvoyant abilities. But there's still some subtle stains on the mind of the arhat in the sense that they haven't removed the appearance of true existence that occurs in the post-meditation time. So even though they can see the emptiness of true or inherent existence during meditation, an arhat, when they get up from meditation, everything still looks true existent even though they know it isn't. So there's still some kind of veil on the mind. When you've removed that, then it's like an infinite mirror that no longer has any dirt on it. Okay? So it's like these different abilities that somebody gets have to do with how much garbage they've been able to remove from the mind. Just as a mirror's ability to reflect has to do with how much dirt has been cleansed from it. Okay? So an arhat knows a lot of the things that a Buddha knows. An arhat knows a lot of people's past lives and karma and things like that. But they don't know everything exactly, completely, totally, just as a Buddha does. So an arhat can still maybe goof up sometimes. Yeah? That's because the mind, the mirror, is very clean, but there's still some dirt on it. How much are the Buddhas intervening in our world? I have no idea. You know, 47.8%. Yeah, exactly. I have no idea, because I think that probably depends a lot on individual beings' karma.
And then why would our karma affect how they intervene?
Okay, why would our karma affect how they can intervene in our world? Because if our minds are open, and let's say we've created the karma to meet the Dharma and to practice it, and to be open to the influence of the Dharma. Then the Buddhas, the whole reason they became fully enlightened was to help us. And they help spontaneously, effortlessly, without having to think about it. So because, you know, our radio's turned on, the radio waves get picked up. You know, I mean, Buddhas just help naturally because there's a recipient out there. Okay? And whereas if somebody doesn't have the karma to be helped, why would the Buddhas hang around? You know, Buddhas aren't going to sit and knock their head against the wall.
I think in America, the Buddhas aren't real present.
Hold on, yeah? They're not selective. From their side, they aren't going to say, oh, well, this guy has a lot of faith, so I'll help him, but this guy's a jerk and doesn't believe in me, I won't help him. But it's just, you know, you give out your help, but if people can't take it, and you can perceive they can't take it, then why are you going to put it there? You know, it's like, you know, the Buddhas are holding out hooks, but if we don't hold out a ring, you know, the Buddha's still going to have a hook out there because they are compassionate, like you said. But, you know, and they might alter the hook to make another kind of hook because, you know, our ring is like itty-bitty teeny-wee. Okay? But, so they'll somehow change the way they help. It's not that a Buddha's going to completely abandon us because we're negative. But if our own minds are closed, then they'll still help us, but the amount that they can help us is reduced because, you know, we're holding out this teeny, teeny, teeny little ring. So we're not even giving them a chance to hook anything. Yeah? So how much the Buddha's intervening in our life, again, you know, for each one of us, it's going to be quite different. And again, how they intervene, we may not even know it when they do. We may not even pick up on it when they do. Yeah? And yet they may be constantly intervening. I mean, I just think of, you know, I mean, there's the Kala Chakra a few months ago in New York. And when we took the Bodhisattva vows in Madison Square Garden, I mean, for me, this was just an incredible experience. Like, you know, 3,500 people saying that they want to become Buddhas for the benefit of all sentient beings. Like, what is going on here? You know, I mean, to me, it was just like Madison Square Garden and this is happening. And I was thinking, I mean, what an incredible thing to do. And His Holiness was really acting like a Buddha in just even presenting to people this idea of aspiring to cherish others more than themselves and aspiring to become a fully enlightened Buddha to benefit them. And He was offering this incredible alternative to New York drudgery. And yeah, and it was a very remarkable thing that happened when He gave the vows. And yet, how much each person in that auditorium was benefited from that ceremony, I think it must have varied, I mean, completely from A to Z. Yeah? Because some people are probably bodhisattvas already, and they're, you know, everything His Holiness says, they're just experiencing as their own incredible, you know, they're having this tremendous experience during the Bodhisattva vows of compassion for others. And then there's probably some people sitting in the audience saying, this is interesting. I get to sit and watch this guy from Tibet who won the Nobel Peace Prize, and gee, he has a nice smile. And he's talking about compassion, which, gee, is a real nice thing. And it's kind of hot in here, so I hope it ends soon, and I'm going to go out and have dinner with my friends tonight. You know, and both those people are sitting in the same auditorium, and yet look how different the help that His Holiness is giving is being perceived by them. And from His Holiness' side, He's giving it to everybody. Yeah? but people perceive it in their own way. They take what they're capable of. And so that's good. You know, people get some kind of benefit. And so, you know, how much we benefit from things depends very greatly on our mental state, you know, on our karma. And like I said, we may not even be aware of how much we're benefiting, how much the Buddha is affecting us in our life. And sometimes, I mean, some of you were there in New York, and you might have thought at the time it was happening, gee, this is, you know, this is great, this is wonderful. And then, you know, 10 years or 20 years from now, you might kind of look back and go, wow, I can't believe it, you know. And it's like all of a sudden it becomes clear to you then exactly how much this whole thing is benefiting you. But at that time, maybe you didn't even understand it. I mean, so many things happen like that in our lives, don't they? That we think we know what's going on, and then years later we figure it out. Yeah? Yeah. Yeah. Very much. Very much. And then you can see how we just close off our mind from this incredible thing that happened. Yeah. Not that the Buddhas or the others who helped us change, but our mind just got enveloped by its own paranoia or doubt or suspicion or whatever. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very true. I mean, even we look here, and, you know, when you study about, like, a bee's eye, you know, how they have these multiple, they have these very complex eyes with multiple lenses, or however it works, and how a bee perceives something and how it appears to our eye consciousness are completely different. Yeah? And what dogs can hear that we can't hear? Yeah. You know, so we, like, even, I mean, you put a dog in this room, and this, you know, a dog can smell so many things and know so many things through smell. They have such an avenue of information that's totally closed off to us. Yeah. And yet we can't say just because we don't smell those things that the dog's perception is wrong. Or that, you know, or whatever. Or that they, other perceptions besides ours can't exist. It's clear even now. You do. And this is also the whole idea behind the Pure Land. Okay? When we talk of Pure Lands, those places that Buddhas create for practitioners to go to, it depends on your level of mind whether you can perceive the Pure Land. Because the Pure Land doesn't necessarily have to be another place. You know, if our mind is very pure, this is a Pure Land. If our mind is just overwhelmed by karma, this is like a hell realm. And you can see it again, you know, how people, you know, three or four people have three or four different attitudes or reactions to the same situation. So it's not that thing, you know, something exists objectively out there like that, but how each person experiences it and perceives it is just due to their own mental state. Yeah, so we might look at this place and say this is, you know, I mean, a hell being comes in here and this is a hot burning hell. Yeah, and a Buddha comes in here and this place is a pure land. And we come in here and we vacillate around, you know. Just spend a few moments absorbing everything.